Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The mass slaughter of Armenians in Turkey starting in 1915 is a bone still stuck in the throat of history. And it's a jagged scar, an area of darkness in the hearts of a global diaspora. More than 1 million people were killed, much more than half of the Armenian nation a century ago. It's an atrocity brazenly denied ever since by the government of Turkey, a crime unrecognized by most nations, but acknowledged finally as a genocide this spring by President Biden. Both branches of Congress had voted that verdict against Ottoman Turkey 2 years ago. We're listening this radio hour, not for the politics of the story, but for the personal experiences of unspeakable loss among survivors and their descendants, family histories too horrible to be forgotten or remembered. Nubar Alexanian strikes our keynote. He's a sought-after photojournalist who's making a movie called Finding Armenia. It begins with his own belated embrace of an identity.
My name is Nubar Alexanian. It's a traditional Armenian name. I'm a photographer, and I've worked as a photojournalist for more than 40 years.
I've traveled all over the world on assignment, but I never, ever thought about going to Armenia. I didn't want to go to Armenia because I really felt like I was American. So I never saw myself as being connected in that way, until my daughter asked me to go, just simply, so, Dad, would you go to Armenia with me? And I absolutely said yes. I grew up in a totally Armenian family, a totally Armenian culture. My first language was Armenian. As a kid, I hated being Armenian. I hated having the dark skin. I didn't want to have the long nose and the funny name. When I turned 18, I was like, I just needed to get out of there. But I knew nothing about being Armenian.
I turned 18 and I went to Boston University. College was my savior. I mean, wow, everything was going on in the streets. I arrived with a V-neck sweater with matching socks, and I was completely clueless. So I picked up a camera, and I could go wherever I wanted, and I've been doing that for the last 40 years.
Speak of Worcester, Nubar, and growing up.
So we lived in Worcester. We lived in a tenement, a three-decker tenement, and my grandparents lived on the second floor. My other grandparents lived a few miles away in another tenement. I was an altar boy at the church. Armenian church. I played the clarinet when I was younger, and my father used to whistle me the correct notes of the Armenian music that he wanted me to play. Mm. My first gig was in a Middle Eastern nightclub when I was 10 years old. My cousin and I had an Armenian band. That was the world I grew up in. I mean, look, I pushed away a part of being Armenian, but I've always loved the music and the food.
In the movie, you say, coming to the real Armenia was like walking into your grandmother's kitchen.
Yes. Every village we went into smelled like my grandmother's kitchen. You know, the herbs and the sauces and garlic. We would be at my grandmother's house, and this is the whole family, cousins and everybody. I mean, I don't know, 15 or 20 people. Nearly every Sunday, she would bake 13 apple pies.
My word.
And they would be on the railing in the stairs going up to her apartment, cooling off when we get there to eat dinner. And everybody went home with some rice pilaf, a whole apple pie, some yalan cheese, which are the cold wrapped dolmas, all kinds of cheddar eggs. And that's what these villages smelled like. It really did smell like just being in my grandmother's kitchen while she was cooking.
What did you know about your grandparents? Why they came here, when, how, at what price?
Nobody talked about what happened in the genocide in my family.
1915.
It took a long time for me to find out what happened to my grandparents, especially my maternal grandmother, who was on the death march.
And that is the story of your film, in a sense, finding your grandmother's village.
Yes. I mean, I used to wonder, as I started reading about the Armenian Genocide, how is it possible that so many Armenians, like hundreds of thousands of them, were slaughtered almost all at once, I mean, in months. And Abby didn't make it into this movie, but she at one point she said, how is it possible for anyone to hate anyone that much? About halfway through our trip, when we were driving through this beautiful landscape, our guide started telling us about the Armenian villages that were along that road that were emptied by Turks in 1915, one village at a time. The men were separated and moved to the left side of the road and shot. The women and children were moved along the right side all the way up to the gorge, the Kema Gorge.
I think it wouldn't be so horrifying if it wasn't such a beautiful place. It made them jump. Their blood turned the river red, and their bodies clogged the river. 10,000 bodies.
You remark in the film, Nubar, that it's difficult to own your own story. It's even harder to run away from it for a long part of your life.
Yes, which brings me to the whole notion of trauma. You don't have to know that you're traumatized to feel the effects of trauma. I never had any notion about that until we were getting ready for this trip. There were times when I was reading so much about what happened in the Armenian Genocide that my wife asked me to stop because it was so depressing. I mean, what happened to Armenians, the facts of it all, are just devastating. But I needed to know. And slowly but surely, some of the trauma has lifted. And the biggest part of it was I agreed to step out from behind the camera, where I had no idea I'd been hiding. Chris, look, I've spent 40-plus years telling other people's story, and I never had the thought that I might have my own story until I stopped running from my story.
Speak of your paternal grandmother's village, Husenig, and your daughter had a map, street by street, of where the Armenians had lived a century ago.
So we found exactly where she lived. That was very emotional for me. I mean, at that point, I felt connected to my grandmother in a way which I never had. And I loved my grandmother. She was incredible. But then when I was in her village and I saw where her house used to be, she was looking at the lower plain of Harput. And it's just stunning. But seeing it and feeling it and knowing that it was there because of the accuracy of that map, my daughter brought a picture, a wedding picture, of my grandmother and my grandfather. And just out of the blue, I said, I'd like to bury this picture here. I just really felt I wanted her to be there. I wanted to do something that would bring her home. And boy, it just connected me in the deepest way, in a way which I had not experienced as an adult. Connection is what being human is about, right? I mean, connection with people and things and music and food and culture and art, all of it. So it deepened everything for me.
No, it's a very complicated thing. And I have to say, I have been to Turkey with my late Armenian wife and talked with Turks who look at you with the oddest expression. They tell you with a straight face that it never happened, or that the Armenians attacked the Turks, or that the Armenians were in cahoots with the Russian Empire against the Ottoman Empire. And you know, A, it's untrue, and B, that they know it's untrue. It's a very odd experience. I mean, I could see it in your film that you were going through it.
So on the first trip, we found three of my grandparents' villages. They were in Harput. My maternal grandmother grew up in Yalova, which is, you know, like a 90-minute ferry ride from Istanbul. So we arrived there, and Akin comes up to me and says, you know, there's a bunch of guys over there in the park that would love to talk with you. So I go over and we sit down, and they want to talk about what happened in that village. And they've invited a local historian to come and join us. Hmm. They're telling me the history of the place and how the Armenians were deported. And then they change their story and say, no, they left on their own. Hmm. It was a relocation. So this historian sits down, and I ask him if any of the Armenians from this village were deported. And he says, no. He ends up by saying the most astonishing thing.
A Turk never harmed an Armenian or a Greek or somebody of different ethnicity.
Oh, wait, I have to stop. I'm going to thank them for talking with me. But I have to go for a walk. I wish I still smoked cigarettes. Jeez.
I'm pretty choked up. Because I know what happened to my grandmother. She and her three daughters and her brother, after seeing their family wiped out, had to go on a death march through Aleppo, Syria, into Deir ez-Zor, and that's over 800 kilometers the way the crow flies. The lie is huge. It's omnipresent.
It's also official, as you say, and acknowledged by governments.
Yes, absolutely right.
Which makes a big difference.
A big, very big difference.
Coming up, another photographer whose work you cannot have missed, Scout Tufankchian and her Armenian Diaspora Project. This is Open Source. The most popular Armenian writer of the 20th century, the playwright and storyteller William Saroyan, was born in California before the genocide in Turkey. Saroyan liked to argue that Armenia was not so much a place as an almost indescribable life link, a world nation embodied in each of its embattled individuals and communities everywhere. Scout Tufankchian set out around the world, in effect, to illustrate Saroyan's point. She had been a young star photographer covering the Barack and Michelle Obama campaign of 2008. Then she assigned herself a mission that became her second book, The Diaspora Project.
It all started on weekend trips I would spend with my grandparents. I spent a lot of time with my Armenian grandparents growing up, and they spent a lot of time visiting various Armenian friends all over Massachusetts. And it was incredibly boring for me. I hated it. I would sit in these people's houses, and they would all speak in Armenian, or in a very specific dialect of Armenian, and they would talk about people I didn't know and things I didn't care about, and I would sit there while they drank coffee, and I would read through the Armenian newspapers and magazines that were always on these coffee tables. And I remember seeing all of these pictures of Armenian kids in Kolkata, India, or Armenian kids in Moscow, or Armenian kids in Buenos Aires, you know, places that as a kid from Massachusetts, I never even imagined I could go to. And so I started thinking about it a lot. You know, what does it mean to be Armenian if you live in Paris versus in the Boston area? What does it mean to be Armenian if you live in the Soviet Union? Is their idea of what Armenianness means to them the same as what it means to me? How have our lives been changed by the different paths taken by our refugee grandparents and great-grandparents? And so as I got older, this was kind of always a question in the back of my mind. You know, I'm a photojournalist. I don't like having questions that aren't answered.
You write that there are 85 countries with identifiable Armenian communities. You didn't visit all of them for sure, but what's that sense? How do you know when you walk into the Armenian quarter or an Armenian village in Ethiopia, say, or India?
It really feels like you're always visiting a cousin's house. You know, I'm not going to say the relationship is as close as siblings, but it really does feel like you're always visiting a cousin's house. You know, I interviewed about 400 people for this project, too. And someone said, you know, I can always, there's always a relationship there when I meet an Armenian, even for the first time, because there's so much that we don't have to explain and so much that we have in common. It always feels like meeting an extended member of your family.
You quote the great late William Saroyan, favorite writer of ours growing up.
Oh, wonderful, yeah.
And of my Irish father, 100-yard dash, all of those classic Armenian stories, Fresno, California. But Saroyan said, sorry, there is no place called Armenia. There is a place, but it's like any other place. What Armenia is people. We do recognize peculiar qualities of humor, of fraternity, of backgammon performances. It covers a wide range, but how would you begin to identify it?
Well, just to talk about Saroyan for a second, one of the things that I love so much about Saroyan is how kind of not irreverent he is about it, but how unprecious he is about Armenian identity, how much he embraces the knee slapping and the beer drinking and the insults and the obscenities and the, you know, instead of this kind of model minority, you know, we're all doctors and chemists and good business people, he also embraces the kind of the way we are with each other, which is the constant kind of ribbing and teasing and the poetry of obscenity that some of these dialects have. You know, a lot of my family is from Musalar, and the Musalar dialect is like 30% obscenities, but like beautiful, poetic, you know, just really glorious phrasing and words. And I 100% lost the track of your actual question because I love Saroyan so much.
My father used to recite to us, not read, the story of the boy training for a race in the town in Fresno, and he's sent away from muscle building, whatnot. The race starts, he closes his eyes, he's running as fast as he can. Nobody has ever run as fast as this boy has run. And then he opens his eyes, and everybody in the race is ahead of him. Humor, growing up, heartbreak, character formation, it's all there. And in all those other stories, my favorite is that book, The Daring Young Man on a Flying Trapeze, which he signed for me, and how he gave up his typewriter. He pawned his typewriter during the Depression just to eat. The story turns at the point where he realizes day after day, I longed for that typewriter. He's a writer after all, but incredibly human, humble, real. I'm wondering, Scout, it obviously makes a huge difference to go out looking for the diaspora all over the world, very Saroyan-esque, rather than to develop the sense of loss, lost land, victimhood, incredible sadness, all of it warranted. Why did you just go out everywhere?
I mean, to be really blunt about it, because I was angry about the fact that the only thing that people know about Armenians is our loss. You know, people talk about us like we are a disappeared people, and we are not a disappeared people. The Armenian story did not end in Deir Ezzor in 1915. The Armenian story continues. I mean, every single person who has a Moderna vaccine in their arm is part of the continuing Armenian story now. I just think that there's more to our story. And for me, that was the story I wanted to tell, was the story of a living, breathing people who had survived this catastrophe, as opposed to just being the victims of it. Because if you talk to non-Armenians, the thing that they know about us is that we were the victims of the Armenian genocide, if they know anything at all. Or maybe, you know, Kim Kardashian at this point. If you're a certain generation, share. But the story of our survival was the one that interested me. The story of these kids in Kolkata and these kids in Paris and everything that we have done since then. And just the story of diaspora in general. You know, what does it do to a nation, to a people, if there are more of them living outside of the traditional borders of the country than inside? How do people change? How does culture change? How does it stay the same? And so those were the questions that interested me. Who are we now?
Scout, set a scene. Could be Paris, could be India, could be anywhere. could be America, where you found that sort of miracle of a regrowth that is identifiably Armenian in some place very different?
The way that I worked, just to give you a sense of the logistics of it, when I was first starting out, it was complicated, and I connected mostly to people through, because this was pre-social media, I connected mostly to people through the organizations or through people I already knew. But as the project continued and as social media became a larger part of our society, you know, the Armenian diaspora is less of isolated little bubbles in each country and more of a web. You know, the person that I met in Ethiopia had a cousin who took me around Venice because he lived there. And then my friend from Yerevan, who grew up in Spain, has a cousin in Australia who introduced, you know, so it was very much a web. But I remember being in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, eating a Armenian feast from, you know, a region near where my great-grandparents were from in the backyard in Ethiopia. And then at the same time, they were preparing the traditional Ethiopian coffee ceremony. And that kind of combination of cultures, I think, kind of summed up a lot of what this project kind of became. You know, because we can't help but be influenced by the country where we have found shelter. The French community, I mean, just to give very broad explanations, you know, the French Armenian community, because France does such a wonderful job of funding the arts, has all of this and because it has such a large Armenian community, has all this incredible Armenian art and music that's gone beyond this kind of, I don't know, self-memorialization that I think a lot of Armenians, we feel like we have to preserve our culture the way it was on kind of April 23rd, 1915.
Scott, I'm wondering, how do the Ethiopian Armenians know they're Armenian, and what is it they cling to? What is their account of why they're there and of their loss?
So their story is fascinating because the Ethiopian community is simultaneously a product of the genocide, but also a pre-genocide community. Ethiopia is one of the older communities, partially because of trade routes, coffee and spices. Armenians were a lot of the merchants and traders during the Ottoman era and even earlier. And also the Ethiopian church and the Armenian church are part of this same Orthodox family. So there are religious similarities. So Armenians have felt very comfortable in Ethiopia for centuries.
What does it tell you about those different countries that welcomed Armenians, including Ethiopia under Haile Selassie a long, long time ago, but also France? Armenians have done marvelously. They've done marvelously in the United States of America, including Kim Kardashian.
And I think it's really important to say that we've done marvelously in the Middle East. I think there are people who try to set up the genocide in particular, especially people kind of who are against genocide recognition as a Christian versus Muslim thing, which is not true at all. Armenians have always done very well in the Middle East. There are a lot of Armenians in Egypt. Syria was the heart of the Armenian diaspora before the Civil War.
That was my father-in-law's first stop, Aleppo, on the run out of Armenia. And he never, ever forgot the generosity, the fellow feeling of the Syrians.
Absolutely. And that's true for so many of us. It's true for my family. It's true for so many. One of the things I am the most grateful for when I was casting around for where to start working on this project is that Syria is one of the first places I went. So I was able to photograph the Armenian community in Syria before the war.
Maybe a wrong impression, but my impression is that the photographers in Syria are Armenians.
A lot of them are. Yeah, it's true. It's in the Middle East. People are like, well, obviously you're Armenian, you're a photographer. It's true. I started my career working in the West Bank and Gaza, and a lot of the early photographers there were Armenian. It's interesting, you know, as a kid, I think one of the reasons I was drawn to photography, and this sounds all very kind of grand and profound, and I'm sure it's much more kind of understated than that, but part of being Armenian is kind of constantly having to explain to people that these things that happen to you, by which I mean the genocide, happened and that they were real. You know, I remember my parents having to go in and talk to my middle school history teacher because I wrote a report about the genocide like a good little Armenian girl, and I was told that I had made it up.
Wow.
Yeah. And so much of it is about trying to prove or feeling the sense that we need to prove that these things happened and that they're not forgotten, that a lot of us have been kind of driven into photography for that reason.
In Syria, there's something much worse than irony in the fact that almost to the day, 100 years after 1915, Syrians, being bombarded in their own country by their own government, left Aleppo. They were fleeing into eastern Turkey, and the very town that my father-in-law had left, now called Gaziantep, but the same city exactly that he ran out of into Syria.
Absolutely. And Aintab is now, you know, was a center for refugee support. I mean, it's true. Armenia itself has about 15,000 Syrian Armenian refugees now. And yeah, it's absolutely heartbreaking. I'm pleased that the Republic of Armenia has opened their arms so much to the Syrians, since we owe them so much. But it's incredibly heartbreaking.
Scout, you grew up with an Irish American mother.
I did.
And an Armenian American father.
My wonderful mother, who can cook very good Armenian food.
She passes the rice pilaf test.
She does. She makes wonderful rice pilaf.
But what was discussed at your dinner table about the history of Ireland or Armenia? And in what tone?
My family talked much more about the funny stories about my great-grandparents in the old country. And I wonder if this is why I was driven to this kind of project as opposed to a project about more explicitly about the genocide. Because for my family, it was much more about preserving the life that used to exist as opposed to the nightmare that we had to flee from. But I do remember, I mean, my mother always tells this story about the first night she cooked dinner for my dad after they were married, and she made loesh kebab, and she made rice pilaf, and she made tabbouleh, and he sat down and said, "Can't we just have some meat and potatoes?" Because he was like, you know, I married this Irish girl. Why would I want pilaf all the time? And in fact, my mother worked very hard to make sure that I was connected to my Armenian past. You know, she was frequently the one driving me to the church bazaars.
For what it's worth, I grew up in an Irish cooking household, very bland, barely taste, you know, almost no taste at all. And when I discovered Armenian cooking, I never looked back. And my kids, praise God, are all superb cooks in the Middle Eastern style.
My husband and I were waiting to go into a play here in New York once, and I had a bag that said something about Armenia on it, and someone went up to my husband and goes, "Is this your woman?" And he was like, "This is my girlfriend." And they said, "Does she cook for you?" This older Armenian man wanted to make sure that I was, you know, keeping up my end of the bargain. "Does she cook for you?" I do, by the way. I do. I'm a great cook.
You know, among other Armenian or half Armenian families, women and men of your generation, what is the deepest regret? What is the proudest common feature?
I think part of being half of anything is that you spend a lot of time thinking about what these identities mean. You know, I have a good friend who is Armenian, actually from the same area in Armenia that my family's from, but he grew up in Toronto, and he and I were talking about how he's never had to think about, you know, he's grown up, he went to Armenian school, he went to Armenian church, he grew up in a completely Armenian environment and never had to kind of consider or work hard at being Armenian. Whereas for some of us, Kharnadzim, the mixed people, you are constantly thinking about what does it mean to be Armenian? What does it mean to be Armenian in America? What does it mean to be have one Armenian parent? And so for me, I think it made me more thoughtful about it and maybe a little bit more deliberate. But, you know, one of the things with this project is I always compared myself negatively to the Armenians who spoke fluent Armenian and belonged to the organizations and went to church and were the kind of stereotypical good Armenians. And I always thought, you know, I don't quite fit. I'm not. You know, maybe I'm not really Armenian. And then I started working on this project and really saw how so much of what I thought was just my family's specific quirks was actually just we're Armenian. And how much of the things that weren't these large markers, that weren't the organization, that weren't the kind of obvious church language organizations, things really were a part of my life and were a part of the things that made me me. It was kind of while I was searching for the stories of the survival of the people as a whole, I actually kind of found my own place in the community.
Interesting. With an Armenian twist in it somehow.
Exactly, exactly.
You mentioned the Armenian connection with Moderna and the vaccine. Nubar Afeyan, the chairman of the board that owns that company, I heard him say once, he's an Armenian, grew up in Lebanon particularly, delighted to be an immigrant in this country. He married a Swedish woman, he said. And my children, by the way, they're not half Armenian and half Swedish. They're 100% Armenian and 100% Swedish.
I think that's such a great way of looking at it. Yes, that is now what I'm going to tell my son. You know, my parents, my family calls that shot the Moderna. They don't call it the Moderna shot. They call it the Nubar shot.
Interesting.
Did you get the Nubar shot? Which, by the way, I did, and I'm very, very pleased about it.
I love the fact that your little boy is going to be 100% Armenian and 100%
something
else.
Yeah, well, he tells everyone he's 100% Armenian, too. And he tells everyone he speaks Armenian, which he does not. He speaks, like, four words of Armenian. But, yeah, we took him to his first genocide recognition event this weekend. It felt important to take him this weekend. I spent Saturday and Sunday and Friday explaining both genocide and genocide recognition to a four-year-old, which was, you know, more complicated than I had thought about doing before.
Scout, you're a multitude of activists in one person. Thank you. Thank you for what you're doing. And thank you for the way you talk about it.
Thank you for having me here. It's really lovely to talk to you.
Coming up, another discovery route into Armenian-ness. Christina Maranci found it in the near-forgotten treasury of classical art. This is Open Source. Christina Maranci at Tufts University holds the only professorship outside Armenia that's dedicated to Armenian art and architecture. She had grown up in the only Armenian family in Westport, Connecticut, with the familiar push and pull impulses around ethnic identity, until the art of Armenia overwhelmed her.
My father came from Istanbul in the 1950s when there was violence against Armenians at that time in Istanbul. He came to this country, came to Boston, and began his work as a scientist. And he met my mother, who was born in this country, but her family is from Erzurum in what is now northeast Turkey. So they came here and they settled eventually in Connecticut. And we had a life. So I have two brothers, and we grew up going to Armenian church, and I went to Sunday school, but my parents weren't what you would call sort of heavily invested in being Armenian and Armenian identity. And we lived in a town, there were no other Armenians. So that was already a very strange and somewhat alienating experience to be Armenian in a sort of sea of non-Armenians. I remember being in class. I don't know if this would happen today, but we had to go around the room and tell everyone what our ethnicity was.
Really?
And so it came to, yes, and it came to me, and I said Canadian, because I just, you know, I really didn't want to have to explain Armenian. And I knew from family gatherings and, I don't know, just you sort of know somehow as a kid, something bad happened. And your whole family sort of knows about it and is part of this culture, but wasn't ever spoken about. But there was this sense of being together in the midst of this trauma. So there was all that weighty stuff that I knew was attached to being Armenian. That was not something that I wanted to share, because I couldn't even process it, you know, with my schoolmates in Connecticut.
Sounds like a veiled identity. Was it shamed? Was it proud? Was it strictly family? How did you bear it? And so many stories are different.
I did feel slightly ashamed. And it wasn't just shame about the trauma. Shame's a strong word, but it was a feeling of aversion to sharing it and having it be out there. And then also, I have to say, Chris, that being Armenian and looking different was another thing. And, you know, I had one eyebrow, like so many Armenians. And even when the word eyebrow was used, I would sort of tense up, you know, you can imagine being the only Armenian kid in a town that was so preppy, you know, and there was sailing and there was like tennis playing and stuff like that. And that was not my world. And so that was me, you know, as a kid. But by the time I was in high school, that was already changing. And I tried to write a senior thesis on the genocide.
Really?
Yeah, I did. I mean, and the story of that, you know, the resistance and the kind of making a stand against the Turks was something that my own grandfather lived through as well. My mother's father is from a town called Shabin Karahisar, where there was a similar kind of standoff with the Turks. So he was an incredible person, my grandfather, because he lived through that. You know, he saw horrible things. He saw his mother and his brother die in front of him. Mm. And then he made it somehow to Istanbul and from there on to easier places. But yeah, those stories of resistance are still with us. And so my nephew, his middle name is Antranig, after the famous general who fought against the Turks. So yeah, so these things kind of live on.
Christina, speak of the art. We know sort of that Armenians had their own alphabet and their own aesthetic. And one recognized it immediately in ancient churches and what sort of thing. How did it speak to you?
My first encounter was with like a library book from our library, which shockingly, Westport had a nice book about Armenian manuscripts. And I have to say that obviously I studied it formally throughout grad school and I teach students. There's no sense anymore, happily, that there's only one kind of good art. The sense of a canon of sort of European and Mediterranean art kind of held up as the ideal is no longer the case. And that means there's room for traditions like Armenia. And of course, you know, there was that wonderful show at the Met a few years ago now, which has really, I think, shown people the incredibly dynamic and connected and sophisticated and gorgeous quality of Armenian art. You know, whether we're talking about ancient to modern, but focusing on church architecture, on manuscripts, that's my focus. I mean, every day I learn something new. And I think one of the most wonderful things about this field is how brand new it is and how much work there is to be done. So there are horizons to be reached, and that's why I'm training students.
I remember that show, mainly the sort of early Renaissance gilded Christian art.
Yeah. Just let's start with the McKim Mead and White portico of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where there was this massive banner that said Armenia. And, you know, almost that is the most wonderful thing about, I was heavily involved with the show and it was a major show with amazing objects. But just the fact that you have Armenia emblazoned in the intercolumniations of the Metropolitan Museum of Art made so many of us in the community just so proud. That was a huge moment for the word Armenia to be how many feet high in the Upper East Side of New York City. So that was already great. And I mean, that was all over social media, people posing with that banner. That was really important, and important not just for the history of art and the history of culture, but for Armenians everywhere. But in terms of the objects on display, it was amazing because you'll remember you walk through the Greek and Roman galleries to get to the exhibition and you are faced with these incredibly robust stone sculptures. The first thing you see is that sort of sculpted quadrangular pier that tells the story on its faces of the history of Armenian Christianity. And then going from there, you are looking at kachkars. So these are carved stone crosses, elaborately carved stone crosses that speak to a particular kind of Armenian, not just an Armenian visual mode, but a form of veneration. Because, of course, these crosses, these massive slabs were venerated and prayed before and often commemorated people. And then there were the ceramics, which speak to how connected Armenians were through trade, manuscripts, textiles, massive wooden doors. And then also in that exhibition, you had a hint of the architectural complexes in which these objects were situated. it was an amazing thing. And I'm so proud to have been involved. One thing I'll say about the attendees to the show, I enjoyed watching them as much as I did the objects, you know. They were so engaged. And, you know, I don't know if how many of them had been to the Met before. I loved that engagement of this community with their objects. It was a beautiful thing because the show was all about connection, about Armenia being connected to so many other cultures, from East Asia to Amsterdam. And here you also have these different Armenian communities, multiple Armenian communities from the Republic, from California, all over the place coming together.
We were quoting Saroyan's line, Armenia is not a place, it's the people, it's the humor, it's the, in St. Paul's terms, it's the long suffering, it's the survival.
Yeah.
Where do you feel that complex Armenian quality as you move around, as you look at art?
For me, Chris, I'm not just a researcher and teacher, but I'm an advocate. So for me, what brings it all together is that very often the monuments are in jeopardy. So in the case of Armenian monuments in Turkey or Azerbaijan or Nakhchivan, these are monuments that are at risk. That means that you have these beautiful, precious, ancient, often sacred monuments that are also in need of advocacy and need of care and galvanizing people, not just Armenians, people from all over the world to care about them, to raise awareness, to raise funds, to support the welfare of these monuments is what for me is the most sort of activating thing about them. And it's something I also teach my students because it's all very well to love and appreciate Armenian art for its beauty and its sophistication, but it's equally important to know how to be good custodians.
How much of the best Armenian art was destroyed purposefully by the Turks who were trying to stamp out a culture as well as a people?
Yeah, that's a question. It's hard to know. We clearly have only a fraction of what once was. Having said that, what I'm always shocked at is how much we have. So we have thousands of churches. We have at least 40,000 known Armenian manuscripts. That is a huge number. And that's only what we know. And I have to say that every other, you know, week, month, a new manuscript turns up in somebody's private collection. So yes, on the one hand, you know, what we're dealing with is a fraction of what was. But on the other hand, we also don't quite know how much we have. And then there's another piece to this. So as you know, there is real worry about, and for good reason, because bad things are happening to the Armenian monuments in Karabakh. Now, having said that, something that I just learned, which is a textile from an Armenian church that's now destroyed. The church is in Nakhchivan, the Republic of Nakhchivan. The textile's inscribed, and it gives the name of the church and the town where it was made. And this textile lives at the Armenian Museum in Watertown. So all this stuff that Armenian art does in inscriptions means that we know much more than we think we do. Because, you know, that church in Nakhchivan is gone. But this textile sitting in Watertown preserves the memory of it. And this kind of story, which there are so many stories just like this, really is, I think, the fabric of Armenian art, as well as the objects themselves.
Christina, speak of your own awakening as a historian to the horror story under all the modern history of Armenia.
It's not so much an awakening, Chris, as every time I read about it, or I hear about it, or I go to a lecture, or more evidence is uncovered. It's just this horrible sort of relearning of what happened. And that doesn't go away. It's this horrible, crushing feeling when you realize what human nature is capable of. And when you add to that what happens with the monuments as a result, and that the monuments become these kind of voiceless victims of genocide, they have no power of their own, no agency of their own. I just need to say that there has been, you know, really important scholarship on the genocide, but my own reaction, it feels just like it's consolidating this trauma, you know, that my parents and my grandparents had to live through. And so there's that, but there's also the dimension of the heritage, which is directly related, the monuments and their precarious condition is directly a result of the genocide and attitudes towards those indigenous communities, Armenian communities, who aren't there anymore. And now, unfortunately, we're seeing the same thing in Azerbaijan. For all Armenians, I think this is terrible because it's just this horrible reminder. It feels like a continuation of, you know, 1915, and it's just a perpetuation of the trauma.
You come down decidedly on an upbeat, Christina, which is fascinating, and it's something in that art that sustains an identity, a set of values, a set of memories, dark and light, but it keeps you.
Yeah, absolutely. It sustains me. When you think about all the people before you that were so productive and produced these monuments that are now living, you know, and whether it's textiles in a museum or manuscripts in a library or the monuments on their own soil, the amount of stuff, the amount of culture that exists, that each has its own story, is really incredible. So above all, there's just so much work to do.
So many reminders of Jews' experience in Germany in the Nazi time.
Yeah.
No question about that. And there are lots of parallels. I mean, the famous story was that Hitler was asked, how could you imagine killing off a people? And he said, who remembers the Armenians? But what do we make of those parallels?
Right. They're there, right? And I think with any kind of genocide, they're there, with the now many genocides that have occurred. I would like to think that those of us who have been victims can kind of share those stories with each other. And it does happen. There have been some wonderful, not wonderful, but some really powerful events that combined Holocaust and Armenian genocide survivors and accounts and scholarship. I think that's really important because, I mean, yes, every kind of trauma like that must be unique and feels so intensely for anybody who goes through it, feels so intensely about you and who you are, right? It's a persecution of who you are, not the other person. I can only think that it's better to share whatever grief you can. And I think just getting to, you know, what Biden did in officially recognizing the genocide allows for that for the Armenians. There's a sort of sense of permission now to speak about it without that sort of halting moment where you're not sure whether the person you're talking to fully accepts it. You know, there's that sort of moment where you're wondering, wait, does this person actually, you know? But now that Biden has said it in words, you know, out there, that's really so powerful for the rest of us. You know, like so many people, I actually figured out how to write to the White House to, you know, send them an email. I mean, you know, in some form, but I'm not the only one who did it. It meant so much.
Well, that sort of experience is terribly isolating, for one thing, and alienating.
Yes.
Nobody understands.
Yes.
I'm all alone.
Yeah.
You spoke of the word odar.
Yes.
Does that connect here?
It's a tricky word. It didn't used to be, but I know that in some circles it's considered a word that is, you know, that's sensitive from the point of view of race. So I want to be careful. But odar, of course, means other or non-Armenian.
Mm.
But it also indicates this sense of what it means to be Armenian and to feel concerned or worried about those who aren't, that there might be, you know, threats from outside your group. And that's, I think, where that word, you know, when I've heard it, it's often been in connection with perceived threats or worries about Armenians and about sort of preserving Armenianness. And it's not to say that Armenians aren't really sort of welcoming and all that good stuff, but it's just that when something like genocide has happened, it's terrifying enough that, you know, you develop certain kinds of concerns about your identity, who you are.
Hmm.
Although the word odar has been around for a lot longer than that, I think.
Who is the grown-up Christina Morency?
Well, I'll tell you that she is somebody who really wants to help other people learn about this culture. And she wants to see third person singular. She wants to see this culture survive and be studied and appreciated by as many people as possible. The last thing I'll say, and this is something I say to my students, is that if there is this amazing, rich, abundant, historical, sophisticated culture that you didn't know anything about, what other cultures are out there that are just waiting for you to discover?
Christina Maranzi, thank you. Count us among your students, please. And thank
you for
talking with us.
My pleasure.
Thanks also to Scout Tufankcan, whose work includes the books There Is Only the Earth, Images from the Armenian Diaspora Project, and Yes, We Can, about the 2008 Obama campaign. Many thanks, too, to Nubar Alexanian, who got us started, whose film documentary project is called Finding Armenia. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from Chris Johnson and Michael Garth. Mary McGarth is our backgammon champ. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.